Good morning or evening, everybody. Welcome to Chapter 16 of ITE 1. This is ITE 1, Chapter 16, second semester. And we are at the last chapter of our course. And congratulations to everybody who's come this far with us. As we're just saying off the recording, for those of you who feel that you want a little bit of extra time, please download these lectures, listen to them over the holidays. You're still in the course for another 6 months, and also come back next year and sit in on the lectures that will be made available to our new batch of students. So a good job, everybody. Well done, and it's fantastic we're at this point for what will be the second last meeting for this year. Chapter 16 is involving internet security, or advanced security, actually. Now, we've already touched on some of this back in Chapter 4, and I know Grace asked a few people to do an extra worksheet, etc. My microphone's wandering around here. So, the things that we need to be aware of as a technician are the types of attacks that can be that you have to deal with, viruses, trojans, etc. The management of computer and data in an organisation, and ensure that the best possible protection is in place. We talk about the risks of computer equipment, both coming from internal and external sources, such as theft, damage to equipment, and the loss and corruption of data. After completing this chapter, here are some of the objectives we should be able to meet. Outline security requirements based on customer needs. Select security components based on our customers' needs. Implement a customer security plan, and perform preventative maintenance on security. Just want to see what's in. I'm just going to scroll down here a bit. Okay, advanced security consists of the following following types of policies. Okay, in a company, a security policy must be enforced and followed by all employees to be effective. The values of the data and equipment that may be lost as a result of not following our policy must be considered when implementing our security policy. Okay, when developing a security policy, select the correct type of firewall, the type of equipment that you want to secure. Also consider your budget as well. Organizations can protect their data using software security. One of the things that the notes go on about here is the Windows firewall, and this is probably a good point to open up for a little bit of discussion. We're all probably familiar with the Windows firewall that comes bundled with Windows and many other like small applications like Zone Alarm and Norton Anti-Internet and whatever else, AVG, etc. So this is the sort of time I might ask the people in the group, what are they using at home and in their small businesses, etc.
You know, honestly, I'm using the we're using a firewall that is a hardware firewall in our home.
We're far from typical, though.
Right.
I'm not sure why this microphone's not doing what I want it to do, but and that was exactly what I was about to say. Terry and Grace have a situation where there's probably a little bit more sophistication in their system than the average person at home. What are you using, Mark, if you're using anything?
Well, I tried using, as of current, I'm using the free version of AVG, but I upgraded to their trial version where they had everything from a firewall to spyware, you know, all the stuff. And it worked quite nicely. Just wish I had the cash to fork over to get it.
Go ahead, Terry.
I was just going to say, most people are sitting behind 4-port NAT routers anyway, so the issue of firewall is taken care by the network address translation. Incoming connections to their PC aren't going to happen unless, of course, they've got port forwards or whatever in, so most people are protected by the fact that they're sitting behind a router, generally speaking.
Or an integrated services router. Yep. So, that's exactly right. Anybody else? What are you up to, Leon? What have you got there for security?
I use the Avast security, the free one.
Well, that's antivirus, yeah.
That's for antivirus. Do you have any firewall that you're aware of, or are you just relying on, hopefully, the Windows one's turned on?
No, she's got the billion, remember?
So you're just using, you're relying on the net?
Well, actually, I'm at my sister's place at the moment, so as far as I know, I'm just relying on the Windows firewall as well.
Many people, that's fair enough. I won't go, I'll come back to the group for other people. I know, I sort of know what Jackie's using, I know what I'm using. Yeah, what are you using, Jackie?
We just got an arm and that's about it.
I'll tell you what, the most difficult troubleshooting experiences I ever had was a firewall messing up somebody's file sharing Windows over XP. The network, and she was using ESET 32.
I've seen that happen. Yep, Jackie's back now. We had a nice big long pause there. Look, I've seen Windows firewalls and, you know, I'm not a big fan of them. I really don't like them. I find them tricky to configure and all sorts of nasty things, and the phone can wait. They can just simply stop network sharing and all sorts of services, and it's a nuisance.
Avast does that
too. In this particular case, it actually added letters to the end of the network names, which I thought was pretty weird.
I thought I'd wait for that phone to stop. And that would change all the names around, because the notes also go on to talk about many people are relying on the always-on technology of the internet. Security breaches on a home network computer may allow a hacker to get in and compromise that computer. Oh, for goodness sake, hang on. I'm still
Elise, you with us?
Yeah, Elise is getting huge delays.
Huge delays. I hope Craig's not on the network doing stuff. Okay, well, if it persists, I've got Craig who's
put on TPGIP.
Yeah, pretty much. Horrible.
I have a real quick question here. I'm looking
ahead,
at
Matt.
My ABG stuff. I am looking at something here that says Resident Shield. Is that the
that's an ABG thing.
That's the antivirus thing that sits in memory. Yeah, that sits in memory. That scans programs as you open them. It's called a Resident Shield because it sits in memory. And it's what takes care of you actually when you click on an executable or whatever, AVG scans it. AVG is a good bit of kit, but has anybody ever noticed that when you take your shiny new computer out of its box, fire it up, log in, it's really, really fast, and then by the time you've loaded Office and antivirus on it, it's back to running normally, about a little bit faster than a hyped-up snail? It's sad that antivirus has done this to us.
That's typical.
Sits here to ask the students, what are security policies? So can anyone sort of, you know, 10 words or less, no, probably a few more words than that or less, tell us what you think a security policy is and some of the things you might include in a security policy.
Maybe I'm thinking wrong here. I thought that might have been basically the stuff you'd have to read through and whatever.
Leon? A set of guidelines that should be used by the employees of a company that states what employees can and cannot do with their computers, what kind of websites they can access, and what kind of access they can have on their computers.
Absolutely. Joseph, that's fantastic. Yeah, basically a defined set of rules. Okay, it also says here, it's bullet points. Define an acceptable usage statement, define the people who are allowed to use the computers, and identify the devices that are permitted to be installed on a network or computers. Define the requirements for data to remain absolutely confidential on a network. And determine a process for employees to be allowed to access data on the network. So sometimes you might get an employee who wants to be given permissions to a certain part of the system, and they may need to get a signature or something from their manager before the IT department will allow that to happen. As for data remaining confidential network, I can tell you now that in the tax office here in Australia, the employees aren't allowed to bring in and out USB key memory sticks because if people did that, there's a high risk of data being saved on them and simply walking out the door. So a lot of government are really, really cracking down and disabling the USB ports on computers.
Another delay of death.
That sort of stuff in at all.
At least you're cutting out severely.
Yeah, really. Kick Craig.
Maybe I shouldn't think he'd be doing that. Though. Just hang on for a sec. He's only just looking at some configuration.
Well, put it this way, every 4 or 5 minutes or so, unless you get delayed about 20 seconds behind what everybody else is doing, and I'm seeing a ping time to the Ventrilo server of 22 milliseconds. Oh, no, now I'm seeing 10 seconds.
Yeah, just give us a couple of minutes.
That was a couple of minutes ago.
He was. Okay. Can I? We got TPG problems. I was just wondering if we can get you to hang on until after.
All right, well, thanks for that.
I'll see how it goes. I think Kerry said it's come up fast again. Anyway, I'll get back to you about 2 o'clock. What's happening, everybody, is here's a good trusted issue of security. I have a laptop that refuses to... the wireless drivers are not talking under Linux, and I've given Craig permission to access it from my network via Challenger, and I thought he might have been slowing things down. I couldn't see how it would happen, though, but he's going to stay off until after the lecture, just in case. How are my times now, guys?
So far, so good.
You're not too bad. We just saw a ping of 10 seconds on our end, so something's going on.
So it's the international link.
Ping's 22 at the moment.
I've got ping 77 at the moment.
I want the Blind Geek of the Day award. I've got my braille display hovering over the ping field with the JAWS cursor, and I'm watching it change. There we go.
So it's all over the place.
I've got a ping of 17.
I got 311 between 311 and 318.
All right, we'll keep an eye on it, guys. It should be all right. If it goes critical, I'll go in and kill the web server on the XSERF, which is a note to... anything between 20 and 200 is okay. Anything above 200 and you start noticing it.
Well, I'm sitting at 76.
Yeah, that's all right. But sometimes it'll spike. As I said, we'll see how we go. If you get over 200 milliseconds, you're looking at sort of a fifth of a second, and it does tend to build up after that. The best way to alleviate that is when the time delay does build up, actually mic off and wait for a few seconds and then come back on, and that tends to reset it. So, well, it should be fine now, though. I think we might have finished.
Let me see where I'm going. Okay, we have here things to be aware of in a company because inevitably breaches of security will occur, whether they're deliberate or accidental. And some of the things you also have to outline in security policy is the steps to take after a breach of security has occurred. Who to contact in an emergency would be one of the most important things to know. What information to share with customers, vendors, and the media? And we see this in politics and some of what goes on here in Victoria quite a bit is feeding the chooks, a former premier used to call it, where he'd go out and sort of only give bits of information to the waiting media. So it's always interesting to sort of see what stories get told. These days it's called spin doctoring. Secondary locations to use in an evacuation, so if you have to evacuate your building, how to get out of it, quick. And the steps to take after an emergency is over, and including the priority of steps to be taken when you're restoring. You also, it says here, just a footnote here, the time it takes to restore normal business operations the time it takes for normal business operations to restart after a backup facility has happened. So a lot of it can cause a loss of quite a lot of revenue and money if you have too much downtime after you're recovering from an emergency situation. So you want your recovery procedures to be well thought out as well. Scrolling down here, there's a bit here that discusses security software and hardware, and it says here, ask the students to have a look at the classroom computers to see what security has been implemented. Now, most of us here aren't in the classroom. If I'm not mistaken, none of us are in the classroom except for Kerry and Grace, who aren't students.
So Geraldine's what I might do,
hey?
Geraldine,
sorry. Gerald, we forgot you. Well, maybe you'd like to tell us what security you've got there in that classroom of yours. If any, this would be good.
We have a big hammer and a baseball bat.
so we can look after the security of the...
And the dog. And my vicious dog.
Topaz, the killer guide dog.
Yeah, killer fang.
And our crazy security guard, Karen.
Essentially, we do have locks on the doors. There is...
Yeah, I was going to mention the lock.
There is actually an alarm system for the building. And generally, apart from
and
that...
And you can get the key from the library.
Well, you can, but not everybody knows where the key is, so it's not too bad. And let's face it, there's not a lot you'd want to nick in this training room, because by the time this equipment gets to Cavi, you probably don't want it. It's the storeroom's the one you really want to get into.
Okay, we're talking here about hardware. Protect unauthorized entry. We've got biometrics, which is fingerprint scanners, and if you are a fan of Dan Brown, retina scans. Biometrics, fences, and door locks.
Anyone seen Angels and Demons?
Not yet, I want to.
I've started reading the book, but it's still at boring stage at the moment. They're still flying him around in high-speed jets.
Well, just after you get past that point, Kerry, you'll find a very interesting thing regarding biometrics. I won't spoil it for you, but the book is better than the movie.
Oh, I know. Somebody gets killed by biometrics. I've already had the spoilers. It's all good.
Secure network devices, cables, and telecommunications rooms. Protect your cable conduits and that sort of stuff. Make sure nobody can sort of, you know, cut them. Okay, let's protect individual computers. We're using cable locks, laptop docking station locks, etc. And we've got USB security dongles and that sort of stuff. Application software can be installed. Yes, go ahead.
Very quickly. If you're blind and you're going to get like a Kensington laptop lock, I'd advise you not to get the one with the combination lock, because reading those little tiny numbers is really, really difficult if you don't have any sight. I'd say almost impossible. And in fact, it's difficult to read them even if you do have sight.
Well, okay, so you can obviously return to software, which is, you know, put a firewall on and filter incoming and outgoing data. Intruder detection systems, IDS. And make sure your operating system has all the updates and patches that are necessary, and we all do that sort of stuff, as we've discussed quite a bit in this course. Okay, how will your equipment be used? Where is the computer equipment located? And what user access to data is required? These are all things you need to consider when you're working in a reasonably large organisation. Security techniques. The first thing here is passwords. Now, we've had discussions here, I know we have in previous years, about what constitutes good password. Okay, we configure our wireless networks to encrypt data so that we know that we've spoken about configuring our wireless networks in other lessons, and also it's covered quite well in the Discovery courses. Okay, we also have encryption of data, and the only way it uses the term hash encoding, which is which I will have to refer to my other page here to go into, but basically we can protect data so that if the data is corrupted in any way or has been tampered with, when it's read at the other end, if there's a difference, you can find out about it. And where is that in my notes? Jackie, did you want to say something on that?
Basically what it comes down to is that when you have a hash, the object is to make sure that the data that has been transmitted is the same as the data that was received. So you want to ensure data integrity. And there are several types of hash. Basically, the most common are MD5. That's M as in Mike and D as in Delta 5. And SHA. And it's a mathematical algorithm through which the data is run, basically. And it comes up with a number. And it's run at both ends, the sending and the receiving end. And the object is to make sure the numbers match in order to ensure that the data is complete and unaltered.
The only thing I'd add to that is a hash is usually used on large data blocks to ensure consistency of an entire transmission, whereas a cyclic redundancy check is used on smaller blocks of data because the probability of a CRC collision is higher than it is with a hash-based collision, and also a subnote to the fact that people have actually managed to crack MD5. It's just not very common, so it's still in wide use, and it's lots of hard work, so people don't tend to bother.
There's also symmetric encryption, which requires both sides of an encrypted conversation to use an encryption key to decode and encode the data. The sender and recipient must use identical keys. Now, this goes over it in your notes quite well, so I would suggest that people do read this bit and reread it again before they do their test. Okay, with asymmetric encryption, this is another new term, it requires two keys, a private key and a public key. The private key is required for writing the message, and the public key is needed to decode the message. Now, the advantage to this system is that you can publish your public key. So, in other words, with the asymmetric method, only the private key needs to be kept secret, and the public key can be, put out as in emails and published on the internet.
Is that by chance similar to like when you're setting up a Ventrilo account for a student? You give them the server address and password and whatever else.
No, that's just logging on details of authentication. That's just what's known as authentication as opposed to encrypting data once you've already got a connection. So what they did is when they Jackie, go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was basically just saying once they signed you up to Ventrilo, Mark, they just gave you a set of details that you could use to log on and authenticate to the Ventrilo server so that it knew who you were and you knew that you had a connection, but the data has nothing to do with whether that data that once you've got your connection is encrypted or not. Now, what were you going to say, Jackie?
I was going to instruct Mark to think about encryption almost as a process of breaking a code. Or actually what I should say, think of encryption as the process of putting data into a code. You know how when we were kids, you had like a Dick Tracy encoder ring or whatever, and the other person had to have the ring in order to get the message and stuff like that. It's kind of like that, Mark, if you remember back to your childhood.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that... Okay, I think it's starting to make sense.
So, once it's been encrypted, you can understand what's been said to you, basically. It goes on here to talk about virtual private networks, and we don't cover that a great deal here. We want to do that sort of stuff in Discovery. It uses encryption to secure data as if it was travelling in a private corporate LAN, but however, we tunnel it into the internet instead. So these are using what's known as secure tunnels. So it's something I certainly want to get set up here at one point, just for the exercise of it, really. So you may hear the term VPN or virtual private networks, and they're always encrypted.
I know how to do that. Go ahead, Jackie.
I should have felt you would have.
We use it every day to check our email from work. Okay, I'll stop now. Now you can go ahead, Jackie.
To the students. Do you all understand why encryption is important? Does it make sense to you why we want to do this?
Seems to me an encryption would be a security measure for sensitive information that you may be passing on to other people that you don't want anyone else to see.
Well, here's a question
nice,
for you, Mark.
There.
Would you send all of your personal correspondence printed on postcards?
That'd be a big, fat negative.
Why not? I mean, you've got nothing to hide. You could just write it all on postcards. And generally speaking, a lot of people, when you ask them that, they sort of say, well, maybe I don't, but I don't want everybody reading my mail. And that's why lots of people should use encryption. Unfortunately, it's not quite easy for a lot of us to do, but it is becoming easier, and hopefully there will be a bigger uptake on it, because too much information is just out there for people to look at if they want to.
Yeah, and it's nice when you visit a website, and a good visible example of this is when you go to a website and you might do some shopping online, and you might find out that you've got the little key, or you know, something in the status bar that says that this has got an SSL certificate, and that the data that you're sending between your computer and the site that you're talking to is
you're
actually
lagging
encrypted.
Again.
Yeah, you did too, Mark. It's all right. Looks like we're all right now. We're back to 12 milliseconds.
So if anyone
was
saying,
well, I don't know, but it's
out,
pretty noticeable that you're cutting out on a serious level.
Is anybody out there?
So far.
So far, at least.
Holy moly.
I'm getting many different responses here.
I just had something go. The ping went from like 7,000 something or other back down to now it's 341.
Likewise.
It might be an issue on the Ventrilo server's end. They might be experiencing high network load there.
Considering that everyone's having it and from so many varied locations too. Like mine's sitting here saying 78. It's been roughly that all morning. Well, we'll persist and we might cover some of this again next week anyway, so let's hope it's better then. We could always do Skype, that's a worry. I'll set up Team Talk. Anyway, where are we up to? Okay, are there any questions on what we've covered so far?
You know, students, this is why we have, for example, the little padlock icons that come up on a secure site to let you know that your personal information, your credit card numbers and stuff, are actually being encrypted so that the wrong person, hopefully, does not get a hold of your stuff. This is what we're talking about here.
It's also a good peace of mind, too, that the user at the end, you know, at sitting at home in their living room shopping online knows that this, you know, at least that the website's taken some, you know, measures to keep, you know, their information confidential and their credit card safe. Jackie and I, a number of weeks ago now, did a security audit on a friend of mine's computer over here in Ballarat. And because we did it for two reasons. Firstly, her card was compromised, her credit card, and somebody in England tried to enjoy a flight for $900, which she had to stop. And the other thing we did it for was we needed to clear that computer so that my friend had confidence to know that that the credit card number wasn't coming from her computer. We thought there might have been some malware on there, and we were able to prove conclusively that there wasn't. So because she buys in a lot of stuff, she lives in the country and finds it very, very convenient to use the internet. So we needed to make her feel safe that if the card number was compromised, it most likely, I can say 99.99999.9% chance it was not from that computer.
It's probably also worth mentioning that when online trading first came out, or when it's first started becoming popular, say for example 4 or 5 years ago, it was highly important that the it still is highly important, but it was extremely highly important that consumers were assured that their credit card information and their own personal data was kept safe during transit. And if consumers at any point think that their personal data is not being kept safe, they will tend not to opt for things like online shopping and stuff. And for a lot of companies, that's a very important thing not to have happen, because you want people buying from your website.
I remember when got into the... Oh. Yeah, go ahead, Ben.
I was just going to say, that one time, and it only took once, for my mom's credit card to be used by somebody else, and she didn't authorize it, and it was an online purchase from somewhere she saw on her statement. Since then, as far as I know, she does not shop online anymore. She'd rather go right to the store, or she'll have someone else do it for her.
Well, and interestingly enough...
Yeah, I bet you're going to make the same point I am.
Go ahead, Jackie.
Interestingly enough, she's at just as much risk from dumpster divers. She's just as much risk from people copying her credit card. In fact, a 15-year-old with a camera phone can take two snapshots, one of each side of her credit card, and go run a credit card bill before she's finished walking back to the car. So interesting how people perceive security. One would hope this doesn't happen to her, by the way. I'm just saying these things are possibilities.
Yeah, my point was actually that the statistics are that between 85% to 90% of all security breaches are actually inside jobs. In other words, it wasn't so much that, you know, you passed your credit card over the internet and it was intercepted or whatever. No, the most likely cause is actually a dishonest employee at that particular establishment, and that can occur whether you're, you know, you go to the restaurant and give them the credit card, or whether you buy something online.
I was just going to bring up that point about the restaurants. You know, a lot of people get the little tray and their credit card goes on it and it disappears for a few minutes while they don't do it. yeah, be safe.
I always like going to the counter, and that's what I did on Friday night when I went out. Not that I have any reason to doubt these particular restaurateurs. They're quite nice, actually. But, yeah, if it's
probably 99% are.
Yeah, exactly. But I think if you're unsure, go to the counter and pay, and you can see. And sometimes they'll let you swipe your own card in the FPOS machine, and you certainly can with credit cards swipe them in an FPOS machine now. So it's a lot safer than it used to be. But, look, I've heard those stories in restaurants. I've also heard some rather bad horror stories here in Melbourne about the Melbourne taxi drivers. Whoops, you hand your... We have FPOS in taxis, or credit card facilities in taxis here in Australia now, and probably many are, if not all, of the capital cities. And you hand your card to the driver, who's supposed to stick it in the top of his machine, and whoops, he's dropped it. And he bends down and picks it up, and there's a little credit card reader under the driver's seat, and he'll swipe it and give it back to you. It has happened.
The other thing that was happening was with the ATMs. They were attaching little card readers to them.
We had a spate of that back in Melbourne in about March, actually.
We did too. A whole stack of skimmers. And a lot of them were done with Maccas, service stations, and there was a whole list of places where they'd basically attached a little device onto the outside of the ATM in front of the card slot, and it was wired in such a way that when you swiped the card into the device remembered the card, it then passed the swipe credentials onto the ATM, which then your transaction ran as normal, and then of course they would come back later and just upload the card logs.
Precisely my point about most of these being, you know, an inside type of a transaction.
Luckily, every place I've been to, they have let me see what's going on when I'm giving them my card. So.
Exactly. We better move back to the lecture. This part of the notes here referred to hardware and software firewalls, and I know for memory, and I'm only going on memory here, a lot of this part is in the test, so pay attention, guys. Talks about the modes of firewalls here. You can have basically packet filtering, which basically allows or denies traffic. It says, okay, I don't like this packet, that's it, you're out. You have a proxy firewall, which allows, this actually inspects all traffic and allows or denies traffic. Now, I'm not sure whether this actually is any intelligence here or that it makes decisions. You might know, Kerry. Then we've got stateful packet inspection. Now, I know this bit is in the test. It keeps track of all channels of communications and provides the best degree of security at all levels. So basically, it remembers for memory what packets it's allowed to pass through and what it can't. Is that right? Would that be a good way of summing it up, Kerry?
Is this a stateful inspection packet firewall?
Stateful one, yep. Yep, stateful
password. No, what it actually does is, well, kind of. What it actually does is it actually pays attention to which connections are currently open and which connections are currently not open. So when you open a TCP connection out through the firewall, it notes the source port that the connection is coming from, it notes the destination that the packets are going to, it then keeps a record of that, and it will only allow packets back from the destination of the connection to the source port and source IP. It won't allow any other packets outside that connection back through. With UDP, it keeps a note of what connections it thinks are open for a given time, and it then times them out after a given time so that it decides that those connections are no longer open. So that's what stateful packet inspection is. It actually looks at what connections are open, which is why it's called stateful.
Are there any questions?
I don't have to worry. Yeah, actually more of a comment. I don't have to worry about this anymore about with the AVG firewall, but when I had it active and stuff, I noticed that, like in my iTunes, it wouldn't allow me to access the radio station channels on iTunes. It did eventually, but for the first couple times it would just deny me access to that portion of iTunes. And
well, this can be configured. Yeah.
The problem. That's the problem with a lot of these firewall softwares, and this is what the research has shown, is that when you first install the firewall software, it's set to some quite understandably tight defaults, and it starts popping alert boxes up on users' screens, and unless it's adequately configured, it's actually going to annoy the user, and then the user's going to uninstall it because they've had enough of these stupid boxes. And I put XYZ firewall on and now I've got stupid boxes. I'll just take XYZ firewall off and stupid boxes are gone, which isn't the solution you want them to take, but obviously they need to know how to configure it or get somebody or pay, say for example, a student from this course to configure it for them.
And part of the problem is for blind people.
Jackie, go for it.
Yeah, part of the problem is that some of these firewalls are not exactly speech-friendly. And so they may pop up one of those boxes, and you don't know that it's popped up. That's a difficulty.
Well, make sure to do your research.
Finding out which ones work and which ones don't, Grace, is very difficult, though, in my experience. And then they release a new version of the one that did work, and it doesn't work anymore. Go ahead, Elise.
Oh, sorry, Kerry, I was about to say, I think that one of the first things I said to Jackie 3 or 4 weeks ago when she got me using, what was it? What's the last one we tried? Avast, that's it. I said, I think the first question was, is it accessible? I'm thinking, I knew it would be if she said to use it, but let's hope it's still the same way, 3 months down the track.
Yeah, things change so quickly, and in fact a lot of companies have released software that used to work beautifully for blind people, and then version 7 came out and it doesn't work anymore. So, and they don't care, like some of the companies don't care. I think at one point that happened to Sunbelt Personal, and that was a big one that a lot of people used to use. I think they may have fixed it, but I'm not sure. It really is a minefield. The other thing is getting accessible to one person is not accessible to another. So JAWS cursorable by singing like Hail Marys while you right-click the mouse button and dance on your left foot to activate the firewall button might be okay for somebody, but if you can't tab, then somebody else might be unhappy with it. So horses for courses, I think.
Well, we had one. It wasn't a firewall. It was, can't remember now. It was a box that popped up on Jackie's screen the other day, and it just was not JAWS cursible or tabbable or anythingable. Actually, we had a couple recently, I think. So thank you for having Skype sharing screen facility in Skype 4. I was able to probably never look. But, it's a bloody nuisance, to be blunt.
It was Java.
Ah.
Right, once to bug everywhere.
Yeah, pretty much.
But it is a problem, and, these firewalls are definitely not designed with the blind in mind, so...
And then you get these, some of them have got these double negative answers, and, you sort of think, can't the answers be a little bit more straightforward? I've seen people...
Oh, yeah, do you wish to continue to stop blocking?
Yeah,
okay.
Right.
And I've
thanks,
seen
Windows. No, Windows does it. Do you wish to continue to stop blocking? Okay.
Right, just ask the question straightforward and be done with it. So firewalls, let's get back to the notes here. I guess you could argue that they break into two main sort of streams. You've got your hardware firewalls, which Kerry and Grace alluded to before, and Mark's been talking a lot about his software firewall. Now, obviously, a hardware firewall is on a box or a machine that is separate to the computer that you're using. So the resources that are taken up to run that firewall aren't those of your system, are those of the computer you're operating on. So that adds an extra level of advantage to it, whereas a software firewall, say Mark's been talking a lot about his, whichever it is, AVG or whichever one it was.
Yeah, AVG.
It takes up resources on your current workstation. And Kerry also alluded with the virus scanner before, it can slow your computer down when you're just listing directories. So they're the things you need to be mindful of. And there are some worksheets in Chapter 16 here that I might get a chance to pull up later on that do ask you to research both a software firewall or three different types of software firewalls, which I think we can all sort of do rather well in this group. But there might be a little bit of an issue. You might have to start using your Google searches the day you do the worksheet that asks you to research for the hardware ones, because they're not what a lot of people might have in this small office, home office type environment. Okay, are there any questions at this point? We're going to have a little quick chat here on Fatman TFS, and then we'll move on. Silence is golden. Let's keep moving. Okay, it just has a brief couple of paragraphs here, a couple of sentences to be honest, and we know we've done this before in previous chapters. Consider your file system when you're putting together a computer and or network. With Windows, the two... Okay, guys, let's hear it. The two file systems that Windows supports.
FAT32 and NTFS.
Thank you very much. And can anyone tell us the main difference?
NTFS is more secure than FAT32.
Yep. So basically with NTFS, we can limit users to put users into specific groups and limit the access to specific pieces of data based on their group or their permissions. And we've covered some of that, so I won't go back over it again. Okay. Can anyone suggest to me another form of connectivity apart from cable that needs securing?
That would be wireless.
Go to the top of the class, absolutely. Why?
Give you guys a hint. What kind of signals are wireless? What type of signals are those?
That would be radio.
Nice, yep. Mark. And what can you do with radio?
That would be listen to everything and anything that's being said on that frequency.
Precisely.
Oh, geez, he's good, isn't he, Jackie? And that's exactly it.
Absolutely.
It goes out on the electromagnetic radio spectrum, and anyone who can receive that signal can, if it's not encrypted or protected, can interpret it. Was there somebody else up there wanting to have a say? Okay, there's the course here covers, and in Discovery, if you go into Discovery, it sort of goes into this in quite a lot of good detail here, but we'll discuss two of them anyway. The first one is the older standard of WEP, or WEP, which stands for Wired Equivalency Protocol. Wait a minute, that doesn't look like privacy. Wired equivalency privacy. And then basically what we do here is it's supposed to give you the sort of privacy that you would expect from that of a cable connection. The only problem is it got hacked a long time ago. We are now.
Yeah, they've even got software on the internet floating around that you can use to hack it with.
Yep, we can light that up pretty quickly these days if you know what you're doing. Wi-Fi protected access, which is WPA, which is what I'm using here, is a little bit more involved and a lot harder to crack, although I believe probably could be done. Does it tell us the difference between them? Kerry, you might
want to
say here. Yeah, I suspect that so hasn't. Okay, so we won't go into exactly the reasons why, but it involves exchanging of keys, etc. MAC address filtering is another way of protecting your wireless network. Now, can anyone have a stab as to what MAC address filtering might be?
Do you all know what a MAC address is?
The MAC address or media access control is an address that's burnt into the network card of your computer. It identifies that card. It's a unique number, basically, and it identifies that card at a hardware level or layer 2 level so that packets can be sent to and from that. And basically, we can, on a wireless situation, a wireless card also has a MAC address, and it can be filtered. So what happens is that we tell our access point, our wireless access point, only associate or authenticate machines that you know the MAC address of. So say, for example, they had it down at the association for a little while. I think Kerry said they since took it away. So like Grace and Kerry, with machines that the access point already knew about, could access the system, but no one else could. And that sort of stuff, unless Kerry hammered the MAC address into the appropriate settings. I was thinking about bringing that in here, but I didn't see the point, because I do occasionally have clients here who need to use the wireless access, and yes, I could do it, but then I'd have to sort of say to clients, well, you've got to get me the MAC address of your computer, and they may not know how, and it just opens another level of, you know, security. And this is sort of, it's like all these security things, you've got to make a decision. Is this going to cause me more problems than what it's worth? Or not, you know, and you have to take appropriate action. You can often set your access point to disable unused wireless connections. Now, you can... Does anyone know what the SSID is? Mark, do you know what the SSID is?
That would be the service set identifier.
Thank you.
Nice.
Nice, yes. Oh. This, you can tell this guy's really rocking. The service set identifier broadcasts the presence of the network. So basically here, it's line star 3.
Okay. Isn't it an ESSID, an extended service set identifier?
I have seen that term, but it's called SSID.
Because a basic service set identifier is something different. There's a BSS and an ESS. If the notes just say SSID, we won't confuse people with the difference, but I think it's actually an ESID, as far as Jaws is concerned.
Okay, well, it's talking about SSID here anyway. Service set identifier. And it goes on to say, broadcast the identity of the network. And look, you're obviously right, Kerry. I've seen it myself, but yeah, we'd probably have to go off and do discovery to find out why.
Yeah, okay. Well, forget we ever heard about basic and extended server sets, but it's all to do with cells and roaming, and let's not worry too much. But we'll call it SSID.
Let's put a plug in for Chapter 7 of Discovery 1. Learning all about, I think it was Chapter 7. I'm sure it was. Anyway, but it's a very good chapter if you're thinking about doing discovery. Go off and do it, everybody, because you'll enjoy it and you'll understand why your access point does what it does and why. It says here also with your wireless antenna, it says you can probably set that up so that it doesn't broadcast your signal too far afield. Look, most of these integrated services routers, you can't really do that with easily. You just get what they give you and you put it on the desk and make sure you put it in a spot where your office can see the wireless network and be done with it. There's probably more sophisticated methods, like a friend of Kerry's and mine would probably think about doing if they want to beam the signal to certain instances, but we're not going to cover that here. Okay, when you're configuring your firewall, you've got to determine your user's needs, and it's no good just setting it up, and as Kerry alluded to before, having all these boxes popping up on the screen and saying to your client, there's your computer, have it back, I'm out of here. There are many technicians who I've seen do that. Determine software and applications that we'll use and will need to go through this firewall. Determine the ports that these applications will use, and determine whether port forwarding will be required, and also configure the Windows XP firewall application. Well, you're not doing that if you're going to use a third-party firewall.
Yeah, it's not a good idea to have more than one firewall running at a time, really, in a software firewall.
Goes on here to say that many hardware firewalls can only be configured for the ports that the applications use. Depending on the type of firewall, the configuration is done through commands using a GUI or a web interface. So in many of our integrated services, routers also have web-based configuration screens or even the ability to telnet into them. Are there any questions at this point before we move on to protection against malicious software?
So I guess what Jackie was just saying, it's really not a good idea to have two of the same thing, firewall or virus. Although it would be a lot worse having the virus protection twice on your computer. Am I correct in assuming that?
No, both are bad. Two of anything is bad. They will tend to slow your machine up and step on each other's toes.
Yes, you need to be careful. All right, guys, we're going to move into a section there. Here we talk about malicious programs. Let's see if we can name some of the categories of malicious programs.
Worms, Trojan horses, viruses.
Yep, there's two. Thank you, Joe. Anyone heard of spyware?
Adware, pop-ups.
Someone's read the chapter.
Someone's read the chapter. Well done, Joe. Pop-ups, firewall. In actual fact, in Discovery, there was a security chapter in Discovery 1 that also talked about pop-unders. Anyone heard of Adware?
I actually...
Which is really pop-ups.
I've got a program, Malwarebytes, that is supposed to alleviate malware.
Yes, malware, greyware, underwear, you've got it. We've got all the wares around. It's incredible. And chapter 9, I think it was, chapter something, really went into this in great detail. So before you do the test for this chapter, have another look at that chapter because it really explains the differences between them. If we get caught up doing that here, we'll probably never get through chapter 16 because it's quite involved. There is one other one I want to remind people of, and that is, we haven't heard it mentioned yet. Thank you, Clockulator. Phishing, spelt with a PH. And we all know, can somebody from the students tell us what they think phishing is?
Isn't that's more of a getting information from, say, for example, an email. And you respond to it. And you give them information like your name and social security number and so on and whatever. And then they've got your information and you are screwed.
Pretty much. We see it happen here with all the banks. The phishing, we can go about this until the cows come home too, but essentially they will trick the user into divulging private information, usually their logon details to a bank or financial institution. They'll even go to the effort of making a website or a false website that looks like your favourite bank and ask you to log in and verify your details. And people do, and then all of a sudden the nasties have got your credentials, your valid credentials, and they will go in and clean out your bank account. So they can use it for all sorts of things. I've seen it for taxation here in Australia, banking here in Australia. You were talking about social security in your country there, Mark. So it's something to be very, very aware of. So if you get an email from Citibank, for example, and you don't bank with Citibank, I think you can pretty much guess it's fraudulent.
Banks won't ask for your details over email.
Exactly. But they do like to, I was just going to say, they do like to send out promotional stuff, even though you're not with them. They want you to be with them, so they'll try and get you to sign up for some kind of promotion that they might be running.
Well, that's just advertising.
That's spam.
No, in fact, there are very clear rules on what the bank people can and can't ask you for. For example, they cannot ask you for your PIN number. They cannot ask you for... they can ask you for a secret question, like the answer to a secret question, but there are actually quite strict rules as to what they can and can't ask you for. And they don't ask you for it via email. It's only done on the phone or on the bank's website or in at the branch.
My cell phone provider, when I go to call the call center, they ask two things. They want your zip code, and then they have a four-digit code that you have to give them, either your social security number or whatever, you know. And if you don't have both of those information, you do not get to look at your bill with them.
Yep, here in Australia, you tend to ring up a call centre, like our telcos or banks, and they'll ask you for your name and date of birth and your address sometimes. And depending on what you're doing too, sometimes I've got a PIN number or a password on some of the things I do. And I've got to say, is that the one with the numbers or the one with the letters and the numbers or something? Which one have I given you, lot, you know? Are there any other questions or comments? Because we're actually moving through better than I thought we would. We're at halfway through the lecture, so we can probably field a few questions at this point because we're about to move into preventive maintenance, and we know we've done this back in Chapter 4.
No, I'm good.
I'm fine.
I was about to say, have you got anything to add, Joe? How about you, Leo?
No, I've got nothing to add, Elise.
Jackie, Kerry and Grace. Right, silence is gold. Oh, and Geraldine. I keep forgetting you're out there today, Geraldine. Sorry about that.
I'm such a quiet little flower.
Oh, you are, aren't you?
And, you know, I do think that...
Sorry, Jackie, go ahead.
I was just going to warn the students, just be careful who you're dealing with. I mean, look, if you have some question about the person's identity or whatever, check about it. You know, one time my grandmother's purse got stolen, and the next day some people called up and said, you know, this is the gas company and we need to come out and check your meter. And she said, well, I'm going to call the gas company and check on this. And she did. And they weren't the gas company. So, I mean, phishing has occurred even long before the internet. If you have some question, satisfy that in your mind before you give people information.
The other thing is, if you get calls from people soliciting donations and things like that, be extremely wary. Don't give your credit card details. My philosophy is, if you want to have, you know, to respond in that, you can always say, well, look, I'll give a donation, but I will call back and give it. So that way you know you're actually making the call to the company you're wanting to donate to.
Absolutely. And if you're dealing with a business and you're not sure they're quite legitimate, in America, we've got the Better Business Bureau, so you can make sure that they have no complaints against them.
We have the Consumer Advisory Board in Australia. They do the same.
Okay,
good luck getting through, though. Go ahead, Liz.
Okay. One of the things that is really big that we need to be careful of in whether we're having a small home office environment like I've got here, or you're working in a large company, is preventive maintenance. Preventive maintenance, it says. It's important for students to understand that that these things are done. Basically, we discussed a lot of this back in Chapter 4, where we want to update, we want to keep our operating systems up to date with patches. Sometimes patches and updates that are available from our operating system will cover up new vulnerabilities that somebody's found. It could also be to fix known problems. There might be a problem with part of the operating system that can be fixed by applying a patch or an update. And is just basically you need somebody to go around and make sure everything's running perfectly, because if it doesn't, and it can always come back and bite you later on if you've got a problem and all of a sudden it just boils over and half your network goes down. What are some of the things you might put in a preventive maintenance type policy? And I know Grace asked a few of you to do some of this back in Chapter 4.
Scanning a disk, defragmented, doing a virus update, a Windows Defender update, software updates on some of your special software you use, a wonderful Microsoft update.
Yep.
Let me, can I address Windows Defender a little bit?
Oh, I hate that thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, that screwed up my OpenVPN.
I had a situation one time where, these folks were working on this lady's computer, and they thought that she had a keylogger on her machine. And the machine was just at a crawl. I mean, it was going terribly slow or whatever. And so I looked at a hijack this log, and I said, well, one thing I can see right now is that she had an antivirus program and System Defender on the same machine. I said, you know what, we're gonna take System Defender off. And it cured the problem. I mean, seriously, that thing is, I don't think too highly of it.
Sounds to me like it's a resource hog.
And you got to wonder how these things got on the computer, too, in the first place.
It was so bad, she couldn't even play music in Winamp.
Oh, God. Sounds like my computer after a virus had gone through and hammed up the registry to the point I had to rebuild it.
Well, you know, and this was actually in an update. I mean, Microsoft, in its, you know, bountiful wisdom, installed it on people's computers.
And that's why I prompted you in that direction, because the next part of the notes says about operating system updates options, and this is exactly what happens if you're not careful. The default, I think, is automatic. Now, this is in your test, guys. I think the default is automatic. Correct me if I'm wrong. I generally forget about the Windows defaults because as soon as I build a Windows box, I go through and change them all. But one of the options is automatic, and that's exactly what's happened here in the case of Jackie's people, is that the software, the operating system's gone rogue and gone, "Ooh, internet, hungry, download, I want updates." And I've seen it happen on people who, in Australia, we have the bandwidth caps, and there's some pretty diabolical low-budget internet plans around if you're not careful. We won't mention any company names here. A friend of mine had a handful of 500 megs, I think. She brought home her Triple E PC and chewed up her monthly download in the case of several hours because she switched on her new Triple E PC and it went hungry for updates. So you don't know what's happening sometimes when... Go ahead, Kerry.
Yeah, I was just going to say, that actually, what I actually find happens, and I've seen this with Windows XP quite a lot, is that you install a new XP box, you forget to tear into the control panel and turn off automatically download and use up my bandwidth quota for me, and the thing downloads IE8. Thanks for that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I really wanted to screw over my lovely little IE6 that I've known and loved for years with the IE8. The other option
is listen,
to go,
I did...
You go ahead.
I did a Windows update once, and the next thing I knew, I couldn't use my JAWS virtual cursor.
That's scary. I wonder what happened.
I don't know. I did a restore point, and then I had to do a .NET 2.0 repair, which is not a trivial process, folks, in case anybody's wondering.
Sounds very scary.
Oh, it is. It's like edit these 6 files, recompile those 7, knock these 15 keys out of the registry, now set the double word value to hex CBF5, restart your computer, run 6 more commands, and you might repair .NET framework. Something like that anyway.
Thank goodness for cats, that's all I can say.
You know what I do? I take and put my box to download the updates and then notify me of what they are, and I choose whether or not to install it.
Mm-hmm. I wonder what happens to the ones you don't install, though. I actually choose the next one down, which is notify me that there are updates available. I'll go on, get on and download them if I feel I want them. And of course, there are basically 4 options you can set this to. Automatic, which is what happened to Amy. Download the updates automatically, but choose which ones you want to install, which is the Jackie option. The Elise option is notify me when they're available, and I did see a prompt this morning on the screen whinging that that I should go and check. And the option that, probably the Craig option, is turn off automatic updates altogether. So just be aware of that. There are 4 of them, and I think it did come up in the test.
It does.
It does.
It does, at least.
Thanks, everybody. Yeah, it's been a little while since I did the test. That's why I said it. So that's the option I tend to use because at least I know that I've got them available to me. As I said, I saw it come out of the system tray this morning when I started it up, so I'll probably check later this afternoon and see what they are.
Just a very quick point I was going to make, far as Jackie was saying, with having updates and things trash your computer, I've actually taken to grabbing a copy of GRML and imaging up all of the machines I care about and stashing them away on very cheap, removable, portable storage. And then when things go inevitably wrong with your computer, as they do, I cat them back, TM, or copy the images back onto the hard drive and boot them up again so that I'm up and running. Now, I'm wondering, I'm going on holiday soon, as you all are. Would there be any class interest? I was thinking of sitting down and doing a podcast on GRML and how to image up your computer. Now, if nobody cares, I won't waste my time, but if anybody's interested, we might put that podcast up because people might want to use a free Linux to image up their machines somewhere.
I think that would be a good idea.
That.
Because there are people out there like
James. My vote.
Yeah, do it, Kerry, because it's all right for us because we've all got other Linux machines and partitions and dual boot systems and stuff, but there's plenty of people out there who don't. And to be honest, I would find it useful too. So, yeah, I think you should.
Okay, we might sit down and do that. We'll K&G Productions might come up with something over the break, I think.
Yeah, well, enjoy. That'd be good. Okay, the next important thing we do is in our security, in our plan and management of our healthy network is backup.
Yeah, and that does not mean put it in reverse and go out of the driveway, guys.
No. There are three types of backups here it discusses. Basically, we've got to perform our backups on a regular basis, and your backup plan might be different from mine. There's a lab in 15 or 16 that asks you to set this up under Windows, isn't there? I can't remember.
I'm just going to advertise the Mac here for 10 seconds. I must say that Time Machine is a very good bit of kit as far as backup is concerned. Very impressive. It basically backs up your machine every hour, every day, every week. It basically keeps snapshots with hard links for the Unix amongst us. And it does it all pretty much behind the scenes once you say, yes, use my portable drive. And for 90% of users, it's brilliant.
Yeah, well, I don't keep much data on Windows machines these days, so I wouldn't even know how to do it under Windows these days. I probably got it done for a worksheet for this course when I was a student, but that's about it. I've always just manually copied off the files, but if you write the necessary scripts under Linux, you can do quite a marvellous little job of it using rsync.
Yeah, there's also a package called rsnapshot, which will actually handle taking snapshots, and we won't talk about that on lecture, but if I were you, I'd have a look at that, because that'll allow you to keep backups of your web tree for like a year, and you can have it in hourly granularity if you want onto a removable drive somewhere.
Yep, sounds good. There are backup programs, and when I was working corporate, we had tapes that would run, and they were scheduled to run during the night, and you could have those tapes sent off-site. So you have to make a decision what of your backups will be kept on-site and what will be sent off-site. There are three types of backups: full, incremental, and differential. A full backup is just exactly what that said. It backs up the entire data set as it is. An incremental backup will back up... Now, I've got to get this right, Kerry. Basically, the changes, I think. Is that right?
Okay. Yeah, what happens? Full
is where you
back... You did this
so succinctly last year.
Yes, full backs up everything. Incremental backs up everything since you last did a backup, and that is to say everything that has changed since the last backup, whether it is full or incremental. Think of increment being plus one, plus one, plus one. So when you restore, you restore your full, then the oldest to newest incrementals. So full, incremental, incremental, incremental. Differential is where you back up everything that has changed since the last full backup. Think of it as the differences between the last full. Anybody got any questions?
But it does not mark the files as having been backed up in a differential, right?
No, it does not mark the files as being backed up in a differential, because when you rerun a differential, it's going to catch all of the changes since the last full. If it reset the archive bits, it wouldn't do that for those of us who know what I'm talking about. The archive bit is a bit on a file that says when a file has been modified, you set the to-be-archived bit. It's actually called an archive bit, and that says I need to be backed up because I've been modified. So what the incremental backup does is it backs up everything since the last full backup, and then it clears all the archive bits, and then the next time you back up, it will catch the files that have been modified because they had their archive bits set. I don't think you need to know that for the test, but there you go. There is an archive bit in NTFS too, so it's still around.
Yep, bit 12.
Make sure you go over that part of the notes. Okay, next bit really goes into discussion. So I'll just throw it open. Has anyone got any points of interest or discussion they'd like to bring up regarding the topics we've discussed so far today?
There was only one other thing that I wanted to touch on, and that is the fact that it's a very good idea to have off-site backups of your stuff. You know, guys, even your home data is important, but when you start thinking about a person's business data, I mean, a person's business really is their data. I mean, if something happens to a person's data, and, you know, I mean, their tax records can get messed up, their customer databases can get messed up. I mean, all kinds of things can get messed up, and, you know, you can see how important those things are. So it's really important for people to have an off-site backup plan.
It doesn't have to be that complex either. Like, a good example of that would be when I went to Perth a month ago Jeez, it's been a month already. I got everything off onto my EEE PC that I wanted to take with me, and that included a lot of data that would have been that I thought I might have needed. I just wanted anyway. But also, I made backups here that I left here at home, but I took it. I took also a backup over the neighbour's place over the road. So it's as simple as basically putting your data onto a removable hard drive and simply walking out your front door, and if you've got somebody in the area that you live in that you can trust, and trust is a good is the operative word here, you don't want them looking through your data, that protects it if the house burns down or something.
I was just going to say that, yeah, the reasoning behind giving someone else your backup is if your house decides to just explode or go on fire or something.
I would have hated it if my house burnt down, but there's a lot of stuff on these hard drives here that are just irreplaceable. You know, just family photos and photos of holidays I've done, not to mention my business, and that just would be absolutely diabolical if I lost that. You know, it's really now to the point where I really should be, you know, burning more onto DVD-ROM and, you know, finding them somewhere to live on a more permanent level.
Speaking of which, weren't you going to send me a few of those pictures you said you took?
And, I can do that. In WA, yes, I think I might have said that too. Yeah, I can do that. Remind me later and I'll do that.
Cool.
Well, let's have a couple of questions here. What sort of data should be required in a security policy regarding emergencies? Now, we did cover this a bit earlier on in the day.
Just something that's just come up, guys. Anybody here on Blind Attic? Anyone on channel on Blind Attic at all?
No.
That'd be a no.
What's
for me,
Blind
too.
Attic?
Never heard of it.
It's a blind list where they're basically somebody's posted to this list basically seeing whether... Well, I've heard about these online courses from the Cisco Academy for the Vision Impaired. Does anybody know if they're any good? So we're just trying to figure out whether anybody else is on the lists so that we can actually get some testimonials out there so that we can actually convince this person that we're not too shabby.
Yes, if Sue Murray, if you're listening, I need those testimonials so I can stick them on the website. And then you can just point them at the URL.
Is it a Yahoo group or a free list?
It looks like a Marmon server. I'll forward you the message in question. Obviously, I don't think any of us are actually on this one, but it's trying to figure out what to say to these people or, you know, point them at CiscoVision.org or whatever.
Yes, tell them that it is good.
Tell them it's worth every penny, Carrie.
Thanks, Joe. Your check's in the mail.
You guys were just talking about the Blind Attic thing. Sorry, I was looking at something quick.
Yeah, we were.
Can anyone get on that list? Because I don't think they want to hear from me again.
Anyway, get
like I said, I've never heard of it, so...
I've just forwarded you a message.
Oh, well, we'll have a look at it. Actually, I think the name does ring a bell now that I've heard it, but I don't know whether it's what it's like.
I'm going to reply to him and, give him the QCAT stuff, but yeah.
All right, okay, well,
thank you very much, guys. Well, we're looking here at 1:25 Melbourne time, so we're getting half an hour to fill. We are nearly at the module quiz. So basically, I was just looking over the chapter notes to make sure I've missed anything. We talked about wired security privacy. We talked about WPA. We talked about securing our wireless. So basically, I know it's a little bit dry today, but... security is unfortunately one of those things we need to be aware of, or at least we need to know who to go to if we need assistance, because there's nothing worse than having you in a job where, for example, all the information on the corporate network has become compromised. I did see somewhere in the notes, actually, about physical access too. So, you know, I think at one point, even as a student, we discussed people with... oh, I know, key fobs. Why did I skip that? There's many ways you can even secure physical security. I must have glossed over that. There's many ways you can secure your laptop. Oh, no, we did. We talked about locks, key fobs, that sort of stuff. Make sure that you've taken all appropriate steps to make sure your laptops are secure. They're the things that are vulnerable because they do travel.
Do not be giving key cards out to people that do not need to be in those offices.
Oh, absolutely. It would be nothing 10 years ago, maybe even a little more now, that people would walk into a building and we had a swipe card thing at the to get in, you come out of the lift and you'd go into the glass doors and there was a reception and you needed a swipe card to get into the floor of the building, basically. And there'd be nothing that, oh, somebody opened the door and let, you know, somebody had swiped the card and, you know, five more people will walk through, you know. And sort of, I don't know what it's like now, but I'd imagine they've sort of cracked down on that a lot. So you really need to not leave your swipe card at
still
home.
Still happens.
It still happens, yeah. Well, it's human nature. I mean, so you're not going to stop people from walking into a building. You know, what do? You say, well, I don't know, you use your own card. If you can't get in, tough.
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, people do tend to cluster and people lend other people their cards and stuff. I mean, that people do try to crack down on and stuff. And I mean, there are whole books on the topic of how the biggest enemy to security is human nature. And it's often people that get in the way of good security, and for quite legitimate reasons. Some security is a downright pain in the backside, but you know, it is usually shortcuts and things that people take that cause this stuff not to work too well. I knew some people who never armed their alarm system because they couldn't quite remember how to disarm it again. And I said, well, do you have the code? They're like, oh yeah, it's... And they told me the code, and I said, well, I can show you how to arm it and disarm it if you like. And they're like, oh, no, we'd rather not. I'm like, oh, okay, fair enough.
Nice, isn't it?
Some people can just be so bland. No offense to those bland people that are actually smart.
None taken.
Yeah, well, yeah, watch it. Us blondes get a bad rap.
Yeah, we do. Well, mine's not as blonde as yours, though, but anyway, not here, but... let's not digress. There's a bit here about troubleshooting security at the...
Does that mean you're smarter than me?
No, it does not. Oh, dear. Okay.
My recollection is that they did quite a bit of, you know, things on the test about, like, USB dongles and cable locks and stuff like that, so you guys might want to... You know, look at that a little bit.
I think it goes without saying that you're supposed to read the notes. We'll say it again. Read your notes. Do we have to sing? Read your notes, read your notes, read your notes, or your file, read your notes, read your notes, read your notes. Okay? So, seriously, if you're doing these modules, guess what you got to do?
And if you don't read your notes, I will sing to you.
Oh, we copped a lot of that last year, didn't we?
I reckon we do the module quiz and see how they go.
I'd like to have one more rendition of the Good Morning song before we finish this course. But yeah, no, basically I've skimmed over that a bit and I can't find it in the notes, but there are a number of physical security aspects with the key fobs and that sort of stuff, biometrics, fingerprint scanners, that sort of stuff. Please read it. But look, I won't go back over it. There's a little bit here about troubleshooting security issues. It gets back to all of the troubleshooting steps here. Ask your open-ended questions. Ask the right questions. See if you can get the right information out of the customer.
Fix the problem. It's now time that wasn't very long before I discovered that when I had a call from somebody, one of my Toastmaster friends one night, and I said, you'll have enough information on the internet. And she said there was a button there that said block all, and I pressed it.
Research the solution
problem
and implement them. After you've solved the problem, you will close with your customer. Well, I think it's time for the module quiz, because then we can finish early and I'll go home. Here we go. Okay, guys, the chat window's open. Question one. Which aspect of security involved biometrics and door locks? A. Securing access data files. B. Securing login access. C. Securing wireless access. And D. And securing access to facilities. Go now. So those people who got D, you are correct. Which practice is a minimum requirement for securing a network? A. Deploy a firewall. B. Create a secure login for all users. C. Encrypt all data. D. Log all activity on the network. Go now. For everybody who answered B, you are correct. And there are some very good chapters in Chapter 9 of the old ITE 2 course, which we did last year, both as a student in 2008, and the same, I think it's Chapter 9. It's either about there, and Chapter 9 of the same course in 2007, where it is discussed at length. creating passwords, because that's the first line of defense with security. And password policy is making the usernames easy to remember, but the passwords not so easy to remember, etc. And they have also come up in a number of the discovery lectures too. So please get some lectures down and have a listen. Okay, question three. Which item physically protects network media from damage and unauthorized access? A, conduit. B, lock. C, security guard. D, video equipment.
Would you read that question again?
Yeah, it's a tricky one, and we sort of didn't really cover it in today's notes, but they were talking about, in one part of the actual written notes, which I sort of went from the outcome base for a lot of it, they were talking about conduits and putting your cables and stuff in conduits so they can't be damaged. So the question is, which item physically protects network media from damage and unauthorized access? The answers again are A, conduit. B, lock. C, security guard. And D, video equipment. The answer is A, absolutely, which is a conduit. So make sure your cables are securely away from everybody. Question four, which type of attack is launched by a hacker appearing to be a trusted organization and sending email to trick the user into divulging confidential information? The answers are A, denial of service. B, greyware. C, phishing. D, Trojan. Go now. Yeah, that's an easy one. Everyone's done this one to death, haven't they? Okay, question five. Where should a technician be gathering data from when troubleshooting a computer problem? So where should a technician be gathering information, data from when troubleshooting a computer problem is the question. A, operating system knowledge base. B, operating system logs. C, user.
Hello, Elise, are you there?
Yes, we're here. Hello. Oh, brilliant.
Big delay, I think.
Okay, hang on. I'm looking at a ping time of 83 at the moment.
I'm at 9 now.
All right. Okay, so can I be heard?
Yep, you're fine now. It's just there was a bit of a delay there. It dropped out for a while.
Again. Look, I don't mind saying it over the lecture. There are some ISPs in this country who do not put in the right infrastructure. Right, okay, let's go. I'll fill up what they've got anyway and to the point where it's unusable. Okay.
But what can we say the price is right?
Well, I think that's why it's filled it up. It's the price is right, so they fill it up very quickly and all of a sudden everyone's run out of bandwidth. But also the international links, I think even for other ISPs in this country have been a bit dicky lately too. Okay, this question five, I'll read it again. Where should a technician be gathering data from when troubleshooting a computer problem? The options are operating system knowledge base, which is option A, B, operating system logs, C, user, or D, vendor of the computer. Go now. Okay, if I'd written this question, it would have had where should the technician be gathering data from first when troubleshooting a computer problem. And the person who answers C is correct. That is because you always ask the user first, and then you might go on to some of these other steps. So I would have rewritten that question if I'd been in charge. And this one begins with a short story. Let's see if I can read this to you. A security consultant is trying to find a hardware device that will allow authorized users to access confidential data. Which device will ensure data will be accessible by authorized employees only? And remember, this is a hardware device. Option A, cable lock. B, docking station lock. C, lockable case. Or D, security dongle. Excellent, everybody, security dongle. So you can have security dongles plugged into your computer. That way, if it's separated, the computer will lock and data will be harder to access. Okay, question seven. On a Windows XP network, which task is necessary to ensure that any operating vulnerabilities are removed and that identified errors are repaired? So I'll read that question again. On a Windows network, what task is necessary to ensure that any operating system vulnerabilities are removed and that identified errors are repaired? Option A. Good grief. Audit both the system and audit both the user and system files on a regular basis. B. Use a software firewall on a regular basis. Good grief. It's option C. Install a third-party spyware program. Or option D. Download and install operating system updates on a regular basis. Go now. Now, after you've read War and Bloody Peace, it's a bit difficult for people to remember, isn't it? So basically, which task is necessary to ensure operating system vulnerabilities are detected and removed? The option we're looking for is for those people who have now come in with option D is correct, and that is download and install operating system updates on a regular basis. Okay, question 8 and the final question. Okay, technician notes that the corporate security policy is referred to as a restrictive security policy. Which definition describes a restrictive security policy? Any traffic that is not specifically denied is permitted. B. Only traffic entering the network through specific ports is permitted. Any traffic that is not specifically permitted is denied, and traffic is permitted only after it passes all security measures. Go now. The answer is, I know it's tricky when you get questions like this and we're all tired. Any traffic that is not specifically permitted is denied, which is option C. So whoever answered option C, you are correct. This brings us to the end of the Chapter 16 module quiz.
Well done.
Thank you. Are there any questions, comments, etc. at this point?
Not really.
Oh, sorry about that.
Not really for you, Grace?
I am good.
Jackie?
I'm subscribing to this blind treasures, this blind attic thing.
I took care of the one I'm just writing to them to let them know, no, we're not spam.
I might get you to send me the URL, Jackie, unless Kerry sent it through and I haven't looked at my email.
No, I'll just send it to Jackie initially.
I'll get you to send it through then. I'll get Jackie to send it through after lecture. Any comments, Mark?
Not that I can think of, actually, at the moment.
Joe, you got anything to add?
I'm good, at least, thank you. Great job.
Thank you very much. Grace, hasn't Kerry, you got anything to add?
No, I'm about to stop recording, but I do have a couple of tidbits of information in a second.
Yet.
Yeah, no, that's okay. You let me know when I'm about to stop recording, but a couple of announcements that I'll tell you about after I've stopped recording as well that may interest you.
Sure. Okay, are you still with us on Channel Leone?
Yeah, I'm still here, Elise. No comments, but you've done a good job. Excellent.
Thanks for that. It's appreciated. And Geraldine?
Yep, I'm here. I will have a little comment in a minute too, but yep, I'm still here.
Good. Well, I'm going to have a comment. Firstly, I'd like to say to all students, either present or listening off this recording, thank you for being with us over the last 5 months that we've done IT1. You've all done a fantastic job. A few of you have still got some worksheets to submit and some exams to submit. We'll keep putting the exams up, so don't feel bad if you haven't managed to get completed this course in time with the lectures, whilst often people do, and it is an ideal way of doing the course, it's something that it is a self-paced learning program, so we do encourage people to learn at the correct pace that's right for them. We also encourage people to use the mailing list and ask questions, and there's been quite a bit of discussion raised from something that was said here by Bob last week, and it just can provoke good, positive thoughts by people, and everyone, we're all here, we're all friends, we're all in it for the same reason. Some of us are doing stuff right up into discovery, others are quite happy to do ITE, but whatever it takes your fancy, we're all here really for the same course, and that's to better ourselves, so it's great. So I would like to say Congratulations to you all for being here for the students, and I'd like to welcome you all back next year if you haven't yet finished, either to go on with, either to continue with this course in, at your own pace, re-listening to lectures, and or to continue and go on further with Discovery, which will also be offered. So thank you for participating. The other people I'd like to thank are Kerry, Geraldine and Grace. Grace is my co-lecturer and has done a great job in the last 5 months, assisting me with the workings. Mainly she's been doing every second lecture, but she's also done a lot of work with the marking of worksheets and also the intake of new students and fielding new candidates. So thank you, Grace, for that. It's been wonderful input. And I'd like to thank Geraldine for her support, because if it weren't for her, I probably wouldn't be here lecturing this year. And also Jackie, who's going to probably work with me next year on the courses. So it's been a team effort by us all, and I'd like to say thank you. Good luck, Merry Christmas, safe New Year, and we look forward to seeing you in all the courses to come. And congratulations, everyone.
Are we going to show up next week for a review or what?
We probably should.
Well, I think we should. We've got one more week to go. But you know, I just thought we'd come to the official end of the curriculum. So, yep, we'll come back for a review.
Absolutely. Thanks very much for that. We're fighting here. No, we're not. No, I'd just like to say to Grace and Elise and to Jackie, you've done a fabulous job this semester. I know Kerry will agree with me on that. And we really appreciate your input, and thank you for those wonderful comments, Elise. This is actually my lecture this semester with you all, as I won't be here next week, but I will be back with Kerry and co next year.
Well, have a good holiday, everybody.
Yeah, you all have a wonderful Christmas.
I was just going to say that I agree with Elise. Everybody's done fantastic. I think everybody's learned a lot and had a lot of fun and probably made some really good contacts and friends here. And we'll come back with hopefully a whole new batch of students, and you guys are welcome to join us, as we said. And even if you have graduated, you can come and sit in and ask questions and give input, because it is a continuing thing. We'll still be here. So you've got that going for you.